And welcome to another bonus episode of Previously in Europe. Bonus. I'm here with your bonus host, Hugh O'Brien. Say hello, bonus host Hugh O'Brien.
Bonus.
And it is me, your bonus co-host, Kieran. Bonus. All right. I've gone mad. I saw a tweet from Fine Gael before I started this, and I've gone mad.
This is...
But still...
Yeah, if you're listening to...
Not about that.
No, this is definitely not about that. If you're listening to this on the regular feed, then... the Irish election will be done. I don't know. Probably.
When this comes out, yes, it will be. Yeah. It will be like a couple of weeks after the Irish election when it comes out of the main feed.
Okay,
but yeah. The bonus feed, this is pre-Irish election, and Irish election Twitter is hilarious and also tragic.
Mm.
But anyway, we are not talking about that today. We will in the future, I'm sure. We are talking about the three main European countries mm-hmm. that have not joined the European Union. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Why? Yeah. Were we not good enough for you? Why?
We are of course talking about Liechtenstein, Monaco, and San Marino.
Yes. We're not talking about any of the micro states because the reason is tax evasion. Don't state some other reasons, but it's tax evasion. Yeah. The countries we are talking about are Switzerland, Norway, and Iceland, in that order. Mm-hmm. So, Hugh, why don't you kick it off with Switzerland?
First, also, let's make this clear. This is a bonus episode that is provided by our glorious Patreon subscribers.
Ooh, yes, of course.
Where we agree to do extra content, and they pick the topics. And this is the topic they picked. Not the topic I would have picked, but okay.
It's a good topic. I like it. People need to know.
Yes. So, Switzerland. I think the reason I suggested this topic at some point. I think the reason was because whenever I originally put it on the list, there was a lot of coverage around, Britain, after they leave the EU, will pick this model, and they'll pick an insert country there. They'll be like, they'll have the Norway plus model, or they'll be more like Switzerland, or they'll be more like Iceland. Yeah. You're like, well, no one was saying the last one. But I think they were describing these as like, you know, these are countries that do fine outside the EU. And especially Switzerland, I guess we'll get into how that's sort of not sort of the case and sort of not the case. It's complicated.
Yeah.
So the Swiss, effectively, the core reason is because the Swiss are very conservative as a country, is the mm-hmm. like predominant reason for this. I think people think of Switzerland as kind of like, banking, etc., and direct democracy is the other thing people think about in Switzerland. And partly because of that, and partly just because of the people who live in Switzerland anyway, it is quite a conservative country in terms of mm-hmm. Willingness to change. Is kind of the main thing. They're conservative in the sense of they don't like changing any of their rules ever, if at all possible.
Switzerland is a relatively, in terms of its structure, a fairly archaic country.
Mm-hmm.
It's been going for quite a while. I think, God, I actually don't know when is like modern Switzerland considered to have started existing. I think it was like the year 400 or something stupid like that. Okay, no, it's a little later than that. It's the year 1300. But still, it's kind of like you'll hear, there's actually some really interesting historical texts of like Irish people visiting Switzerland, like when it first started.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like exactly the same, basically.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing I would want to kind of put into context, I just looked it up there to confirm the date. Switzerland didn't join the United Nations until the year 2002.
Yeah. 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 And that is like, you see this come up again and again with Swiss referendums, of which there are, you know, there's 3 a year, 4 a year. I forget exactly how many they, like, how they divided up. But you do see this if you kind of like look back through multiple years of Swiss referendums, things that kind of in some way could be argued as taking away some sort of control from the Swiss government or Swiss people for something, regardless of what it is, often get elected, or when they get passed, it's by slim majorities.
Yeah.
And going back to their relationship with the EU, so Switzerland is kind of the oddest case because they're a member of the European Free Trade Association, but they're not part of the European Economic Area.
Which the other two that we're going to talk about today are.
Yes. Which makes them kind of odd, because they have, like, in principle, a free trade agreement, but that is quite old, and they aren't part of the European Economic Area due to, in December 1992, they had a referendum, and this, if you thought other votes and things were close, this was rejected by 50.3% of voters. And it was very much down, like, there is, like, a cultural divide in Switzerland, kind of being the French and German-speaking cantons, more generally. I think this was the German-speaking cantons generally voted against. So, like, the east of Switzerland, pretty much across the board, voted against joining the European Economic Area. Kind of, in some ways, the more, like, fiscally conservative, I guess, bit of Switzerland, to an extent.
Yeah.
So this was kind of at the time there where this caused a lot of problems, because there effectively seemed to be in the Swiss government moves to start working out how to, like, start accession to the EU. So, like, up until the mid, like, late 2000s, there was they were still technically, like, an accession state. They, like, had proceedings to join the EU. It just wasn't progressing. And it wasn't progressing because they didn't join the European Economic Area, which is something you have to do before you join the EU. So instead of that, their relationship with the EU is they have a lot of just bilateral agreements that are with the EU, instead of them having different deals with each country. So they negotiate with the EU on the EU level. So they had a package of agreements that took a long time to negotiate that passed in May 2000. This was basically, instead of joining the European Economic Areas, they came up with, like, a load of more specific agreements they could have that kind of didn't change as per like the all of the heads of state getting together and deciding that the European Economic Area rules change. It's more of a, you need to renegotiate things with Switzerland. They also are a member of the Schengen Area, which again makes this more confusing, but that's more of a practical thing.
It'd be very hard not to be if you were Switzerland.
Yeah, exactly. And then so this is kind of more recently has become more complicated. They're also technically signed up to the way the EU is technically supposed to deal with refugees, which is the Dublin Regulation, where on their first port of entry is where they're supposed to be processed. And again, this is kind of, like, actually quite advantageous for Switzerland, because it's inland and there's no way to get there as your first port of call, effectively.
Yeah.
And they also, like, had freedom of movement agreements for some non-Schengen, more recent EU members. So, like, Romanians have freedom of movement in Switzerland, as do Bulgarians. But notably, Croatians don't. And that's because in 2014, there was a federal popular initiative, so one of the referendums, that was against mass immigration, which effectively was like a semi-vague, we need to limit freedom of movement from EU member state people in some way. And this was, again, this also passed by 50.3% of voters.
Jesus Christ.
This has had, like, a weird knock-on effect where... this was kind of the argument that a lot of articles would make when they were saying the Swiss model is a bad model for how you want to negotiate with the EU. And, like, a lot of people in the EU, like, a lot of member states of the EU think this as well, because it makes the Swiss relationship incredibly complicated, and there's, like, a big push to kind of have one massive deal they agree on instead of, like, multiple bilateral agreements that govern different bits. Because you run into problems like this where the agreements are set up in such a way that if, by passing referendum, you cause problems with one of the previous deals, all of the clauses in that deal are no longer valid because they were all codependent on each other. So when the Swiss passed this, they lost access to a lot of the European Research Council grants. So there's actually currently a big problem in Switzerland where there's been a massive drop off in research funding, because they were, like, in terms of, like, a pipeline to apply for grants and then do research based on those grants, the EU, like, a lot of the Swiss money went via that system, and now that suddenly is no longer the case. So there's been a big shortfall in terms of institutions, like, especially, like, Swiss institutions is a good example where, like, it's a small country and they might not necessarily have, like, the number of researchers available for something. So they would collaborate with, say, a French university or a German university, and they would apply for a grant together, but once they're no longer eligible for these grants, it causes a big problem. It's just like, oh god, there's Yeah, and then yeah, on top of that, Croatia, there's like Croatians don't have freedom of movement in Switzerland, which kind of made everything very complicated. And there's also an upcoming vote where there's a Schengen initiative coming through that is going to limit like firearm ownership and what kind of firearms you're allowed to own. And a lot of the conservative nationalists in Switzerland are very against this and are trying to push through a citizens initiative that again will invalidate some large parts of a previous agreement, and they'll have to renegotiate and replace it. But in the interim, because the Swiss referendum will come into force, they'll just be like this shortfall in their relationship. So it's kind of on paper, like the reason that Switzerland isn't part of the EU is because they want autonomy and they're very conservative and don't want change pushed on them. But in effect, what they've set up is this very, very complicated arrangement that randomly changes every once in a while when they change something internally. So like there's kind of an illusion of being cut off, while also it's kind of like you set off a lot of dominoes anytime you change anything in Switzerland now, to a certain extent, which is good fun. The Swiss have their reasons, but I don't think you would, like, as in it's not popular to like the idea of joining the EU in Switzerland. I think part of the reason behind that and the reason that you wouldn't expect public opinion to change is, we talked about this in our Healthcare of Europe bonus episode, where effectively the think tank whose report I was kind of like reading over made a big point of going, you realistically can't look at the Swiss healthcare model as an example for how healthcare could work in any other country, because it only works because everyone in Switzerland across the board is so wealthy, because it's so prohibitively expensive to live there in the first place, and that has meant wages are incredibly high, everything is incredibly expensive, and therefore, because everyone has so much money, you can have a, in theory, entirely private healthcare system, and it's totally fine, and very few people actually fall off the system. In a similar way, they can have a setup where they effectively have so much money that they have the push to be able to go, well, we're willing to do these concessions because they really won't affect us that much. We have this incredible bubble that we can semi-exist in, and it's semi-permeable, but it's very much a special case. It kind of only works because they're already set up as Switzerland.
Yeah, good old ridiculously rich Switzerland. When you have that much money, you don't have to change ever.
Yeah, well, I mean, you will. You just will change much slower than everyone else.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's very hard to imagine Switzerland ever really joining, to be honest. It feels like it would be such a... They would have to effectively change like huge parts of how their society is run, because if they joined, they'd become a very like inconvenient member. Because of the direct democracy system, it would probably gum up the works massively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or they would be a member of the European Union where either A, most European Union laws didn't apply to them, or B, they constantly had a bunch of rules applied to them that they didn't want applied to them.
Yeah. I think the... so like when they last had a referendum on this, it was 76% against. So it's kind of like not... Like it's not like it's not likely they're going to get such a big shift in political opinion in any reasonable time. I guess they're happy with things just moving very slowly.
Speaking of political opinions shifting over time, Norway. Alright, Norway is next on our list. And Norway is, to clarify for anyone who doesn't know, not a member state of the European Union, the Kingdom of Norway. It is a member of the European Economic Area and the European Free Trade Agreement, the EFTA and the EEA. So, that's pretty well integrated already. And they've had two referenda already on joining. One in 1972 and one in 1994. I thought they were pretty close until I heard the numbers from Hugh's close-ass results. Yeah. But, okay, so 1972 Norwegian European Communities Membership Referendum. 53.5% against. joining.
That is pretty close, really.
Yeah, with a 79% turnout. Hmm. Then in 1994, they had it again, but it was the Norwegian European Union membership referendum because it had changed. Hmm. And the numbers had slightly changed. Turnout was up 88.6%, and 52.2% were against. So that's a drop of 1%. With each referendum being 22 years apart, that means in about 66 years, if this trend continues. It's also looking unlikely. I think other things since 1994 have changed the Norwegian opinion. Mm-hmm. Politics in that country have also kind of changed themselves. So let's talk about where they kind of stand and all of this, and the main reasons why they don't want to join. Mm-hmm. Norway's has applied for the European Union, mm-hmm. I should say, mm-hmm. but their application is frozen, not withdrawn.
Right.
So it's still technically in limbo. They are still constantly applying. Although they've formally frozen it, unlike, say, Turkey, which just keeps kind of it up in the air. Mm-hmm. Norway could renew this process at any point if the political will exists, but we'll get to that in a bit. The common fisheries policy is the main reason stated for apprehension about joining.
Yeah.
Fishing in Norway is a big part of their economy. Mm-hmm. One other reason that is commonly stated but has been kind of like debunked, but you know, you can debunk things for as long as you want. It's still like a... Yeah. The kind of stated reason is that they would... Because Norway is so rich, they would pay in a lot without really receiving a lot in benefits. Mm-hmm. So main thing being that Norway doesn't really have any underdeveloped regions. Mm. Norway doesn't have a lot of agriculture. It relies heavily on like imports. So things like, you know, like there wouldn't be any like reason to be signed up for the common agricultural policy because they don't have a huge agricultural industry. That's kind of like what their stated reasons against. And their concern is they would pay a huge contribution towards. The reason this is kind of like a non-argument, though, even though it's constantly made, is due to Norway's current relationship with the EEA and EFTA, they already do pay into the European Union.
Yeah.
They also already have a grant program mm-hmm. for... while there's an EU kind of like reducing social and regional inequality program, there is like a version of that or an extension of that that applies to the EEA, EFTA countries.
Yeah.
So Norway is also receiving structural funds money as well. It's just, they're probably correct. It's probably not a huge amount compared to other countries that need it more. Norway has oil.
Yeah. I think that's the criticism that's often brought up when people are like, oh, the UK should join the EEA is, well, then the UK would end up paying like a not dissimilar amount of money. Like it would be less, but it wouldn't be the people who have the problem of paying money into a centralized EU fund would still have that problem because it'd be the same. It'd be the same in thing in principle. It would just be the number value would be different. But like, curiously, also on top of that, like, so Switzerland also pays money into the structural fund, which like when I read it again, I was like, oh no, I remember this, but I had kind of forgotten. I assumed it was an EEA thing, but it's not. It's like part of their bilateral agreements. I think like one of the examples brought up was like when Poland joined, a lot like the Swiss money that year was largely used to build train stations in Poland, and that's where most of that money went. It's kind of like, it's not really something that like the conservatives who are against European integration, if they do know about that, it would make them annoyed and they'd be like, couldn't we have negotiated a deal about this? Or are just willing to ignore it and still use it as a reason for not joining because they're like, we'd have to pay more. It's very different. I think it's a very different conversation versus the assumption that they have like a very, very different relationship than they would have if they were EU members.
Mm. So it's actually interesting you kind of said that, because one of the things I found particularly interesting is that one of, like, currently the third largest party in the Norwegian parliament is Progress Party, which is started as like a libertarian party in the 70s, but has like slowly morphed into very Islamophobic, anti-immigrant right-wing party. And interestingly enough, they're actually, their stance is against EU membership, but maintaining the EEA, which they acknowledge, like, has, like, you know, the open border relationship with the rest of the EU, requires structural funds. Interestingly, though, their argument is that they're happy to pay the structural funds because it's if things are better there, they're less likely to come here, is kind of their argument, which is super interesting because that's not a position you often hear taken by parties that occupy that political space.
No, but it's a very common refrain for, like, center to center right EU country parties that as an argument about, like, a benefit of the EU is, like, we don't have to have a lot of immigration from Eastern Europe because we're making their country much better. It's like, oh
yes.
Yeah,
sure. I think in fairness, though, that this party often will just, like, kind of immediately pivot to Muslim immigrants, which they acknowledge come from outside the EU. So, speaking of parties, we can talk about party support. So, the traditional parties of Norway, the two major traditional parties, the Conservative and Labour, both support membership. But basically, ever since the 1994 referendum, this has basically become kind of a non-issue or something not worthy talking about. Both the Conservative and Labour parties, while their official line is we support joining the EU, they don't really whip their membership to back that position. So there's substantial factions in both parties that are for leaving, and they are for remaining outside the EU. And both parties are effectively afraid of pushing that issue too hard because it could cause their parties to fracture. Similarly, a lot of the parties that aren't the two major parties, with the exception of the Liberal Party of Norway, are against joining. Either they're against the current relationship and joining, or they're fine with the current relationship and don't really see the need to go any further. Norway is a fairly fractured political system, so chances are coalitions are running. There's a coalition right now, for example. And Norway has this interesting coalition building system that is, I think, unique to Norway. When I looked up the, like, information about it, it only really cited Norway as doing this. A thing called suicide paragraphs. So a suicide paragraph is basically a written thing that occurs in a coalition agreement. That's basically like, if this topic is brought up, we're out.
That kind of system where you have, like, electoral pacts and stuff, you know, it's it's sensible. I guess it's quite a funny funny name for it.
It's a funny name, and I think compared to other systems, it's a bit more formalized. Whereas, like, if a coalition happens, like, in Ireland between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, it's basically for the, like, talking heads, the pundits, to kind of postulate what would be the deal breakers, rather than the party, like, being, like, necessarily outright stating it.
I guess, from the perspective of, you know, once you have more than kind of two parties at a time, you kind of need to have, well, I want to make it very clear that don't forget that this is, like, our red line.
And with, like, more than two parties is also pretty common. Like, the current, well, up until, like, very recently, the ruling coalition of Norway was a four-party coalition. But yeah, suicide paragraphs for a lot of, like, the minority parties within a coalition tend to include the don't bring up the EU thing. And again, also, it seems to be, in the general public, a bit of a electoral suicide to really push for it. Other than the Liberal Party, who's kind of made that a part of their brand about joining and maintaining the current relationship, as well as you know, adding to it. The rest of it is kind of like there is a 70% public support according to like the 10-year average, or the average currently this year, and that's been mapped across the last 10 years, and the numbers do not change that much. 70% against joining.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So Norway is one of those situations where I've often summarized it when people ask in conversation, the main parties are for it, the people are against it. That's because that's where it stands. Like, combined, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, well, more often than not, will make a majority of political power. They just don't work together. But 70% of the public being against it is pretty damning.
Majority. That's pretty convincing. I think it's, it's to a certain extent, they're missing the boat on it. Because I know we're going on like 30 years almost at this point since the last time they had a referendum on it. But it's, you know, that's like enormous bits of the public would just be like, well, I mean, what's wrong with the current relationship? Do you want to spend your entire political, like, as in, are you voting for someone so they can spend their entire political capital for a few years on negotiating EU accession and then several years of back and forth going, the EU wants us to change this, but it's unpopular domestically. We don't want to change it. We've enraged the fishing community industry. It's just like, it's kind of not worth it because they're in the EEA and their relationship is largely resolved to a certain extent.
There's kind of two things I would say about that. The second thing kind of transitions nicely to the next country, but so to give you an example, the latest kind of poll was conducted in June of last year. They regularly only do like maybe two a year. It's not a question that comes up too often, but polling does exist. So while 67% were against joining, it was 22% in favor of joining. And this is pretty common as well. If you go through the numbers, example, in 2011, it was 70.8 in favor of in favor of staying out, with 18.6 in favor of joining. There is also a substantial amount of don't knows in a lot of these polls. In actuality, it seems ever since about 2003 and definitely since 2008, the gap between the two camps has grown even more distant, which leads us to our next one, which is Iceland. And I think Iceland is kind of indicative of a situation that has definitely tarnished the idea of joining the EU a lot since the question first arose for these countries. So, because notably, we're talking about the countries in Western Europe who aren't members. A lot of the Eastern European countries are currently members, or it's kind of assumed that they will one day or want to join because of the economic disparity. But these Western European countries are all relatively rich, and the option to join the European Union has basically been open to them since the European Union's foundation, unlike former Warsaw Pact countries. Iceland. So there's a lot of reasons touted as to why Iceland doesn't want to join. Some I find kind of dubious. Some I find kind of silly. But I will start with the reasons that are probably true. Fishing, again, like Norway, fishing makes up a huge part of Iceland's economy. And they are afraid of what the common fisheries policy would do. Similarly, unlike Norway, but in a similar kind of reason, agriculture is a huge part of the Icelandic economy, and they're afraid of what the common agricultural policy would do to that section of their economy. And the third thing is that Iceland actually has quite close ties to the US. They kind of rely on the US for a lot of various things, imports, exports, and that seems very reminiscent of Ireland before we joined. Basically, ever since Ireland joined the European Union, we've effectively slowly pivoted towards being more EU-focused when previous to that, we were kind of like a transatlantic economy. Yeah. Which I think we had the time to successfully do that. I think Iceland would be joining now a far more integrated union where expectations would be made, would be expected a lot sooner.
Yeah, there's much more established rules as well in terms, and like things have kind of worked out over time that Iceland would have to kind of shift to the agreements very suddenly, which would be quite difficult. And also, like, similarly, they'd Iceland has a lot of like advantageous, in a way similar to Ireland, but a lot of other countries. There's a lot of quite a few US companies that have kind of like a satellite or a small presence in Iceland for the purpose of like EEA access to a certain extent, but also it's like geographically a convenient stopping off point for like transatlantic travel. So it's like a sensible place to have a international bank's small presence also in Iceland, which is kind of, you know, neither here nor there, but it would be kind of something that like joining the EU would in no way be advantageous for that setup. It would be sort of take away from it.
Yeah, if particularly if they had like a relatively hostile trade wielding US government, which is kind of what's currently happening, although I would suspect a lot of America would notice. Joining the EU might be viewed as kind of like a move of aggression.
Yeah, right.
Kind of like we're leaving your sphere of influence slightly.
Yeah.
But let's see. The main, I think one of the most damaging reasons, and I think one that has basically tanked the EU's popularity, also certainly in Norway since it happened, was 2008. The 2008 financial crisis, global financial crisis, the 2011 euro crisis, and everything kind of related to that has kind of tarnished the reputation, particularly in Iceland, where Iceland also had a hard time after 2008. It debated, actually, in 2008, joining the euro and was rejected by the European Central Bank as basically not meeting the criteria. You have to be an EU member first, according to the European Central Bank.
Yeah.
Kind of when Iceland pointed to other countries, it kind of made the case that, look, those are micro states that are heavily dependent on neighboring economies, or they're illegally, technically, unilaterally using the euro currency, in the case of like Kosovo and Montenegro, which in fairness, they were illegally unilaterally using the Deutschmark before they switched to the euro. So that makes sense. But yeah, Iceland did debate it. And then that's also when you had, in 2008 was also when you had the highest support amongst the Icelandic public to joining.
Yeah.
They viewed the EU, incorrectly back then, as a system that would have protected them from the global economic shock.
Yeah.
But then seeing everything that happened in Greece, Iceland got very apprehensive.
Yeah.
And it still seems, from Icelandic people I've interacted with, it still seems to be the conception that they would, if another economic downturn happened, they would be just, you know, cold Greece.
Yeah,
because like it was pretty bad in 2008. I remember, so my distinct memory of 2008 and Iceland is me in about 2008 finally getting the online news service on my Wii to work, my Nintendo Wii, and the big story of the day on that was last McDonald's closes in Iceland.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they had a bad time in the economic crash. It wasn't good. And exactly, they probably would have been forced into a austerity heavy bailout deal.
Yes,
the EU would have very much held all the cards in. And I don't know if anyone else noticed, but the Greek people didn't like that.
No, they did not. But I also want to kind of look at some of the more dubious reasons that are floated about Iceland.
Okay, yeah, go on.
But why they haven't joined and why I think they're kind of dubious. One is Iceland's current electoral system favors rural areas, which are more Eurosceptic.
Does it?
Yeah, I'm not sure that. Yeah, so there's that aspect. But even if that was the case, I'm not sure that's really going to be a thing, because Iceland's entire relationship about like applying for membership, withdrawing membership, has all been like done without referendum.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so it doesn't,
the public, yeah, the public is not basically like considered other than like approval ratings, mm-hmm. which basically just means you're not really considering the public at that point, you're considering your party base.
Yeah.
The next one is, might be true, but it seems a bit airy-fairy, which is Iceland's elite go to colleges in largely Eurosceptic countries. The USA, UK, and Scandinavian countries.
The other Scandinavian countries aren't really, unless they all go to university in Norway, which I don't think I don't think is the contention.
I think Scandinavian countries are historically Eurosceptic, like none of them use the euro is a good example.
Yeah, that's true.
But also two out of three of them are in the EU.
Yeah. And also I don't think anyone would say that the UK university system is particularly anti-Europe.
Yeah.
No. Even in the business focused institutions, I think the teaching consensus from the London School of Economics isn't EU bad. It's anyway, it's not important. I see why you think that's dubious. I think that's probably quite tenuous as a.
Yeah, that seems like something that can be thrown out in an op-ed or like a talking head on a TV show, and no one really doing any pushback on it because it kind of sounds true.
And it's very difficult to disprove because you're like, yes. I don't have time to go interview hundreds of people to go check.
Yeah, I mean, there's also an argument to be made that while UK colleges are not necessarily Eurosceptic, I'd imagine the version of UK colleges experienced by the moneyed Icelandic elite might be, but then they were chances are they probably had those beliefs before they went. The last dubious reason I find very interesting is being cited is Iceland's colonial past. Iceland is a former colony of Denmark, and I find that very dubious, to be honest, because Ireland's main drive towards EU membership is because of our colonial past. We kind of view it as a support structure because our colonial mindset kind of dictates that we don't really feel like we can go it alone.
Well, that's not appealing if someone's offering you a structure where you can have actually disproportional input to your size.
As often kind of stated when why Ireland isn't Eurosceptic, it's a good point that Ireland views its EU membership as a safeguard against what would be de facto British social and economic dominance, mm-hmm. if we were both outside of the structure. So that's kind of weird. And again, the last reason, hard to measure or disprove.
Yeah.
But the funny reason, the one that I found, is the Cod Wars.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
Yeah. So people have pointed, this could be true, I kind of believe this. People pointed to the Cod Wars, which was this trade war that slightly escalated, mm-hmm. Between Iceland and the UK, uh-huh. Over fishing rights.
Yeah.
If I remember that, yeah, that's basically what happened there. And Iceland won that, effectively. They got what they wanted out of that conflict. Mm-hmm. And people have posited this gives Iceland a sense of inflation, uh-huh. a sense that they can handle their own without a larger support structure, because they took on a country with a population of 64 million people.
Versus 300,000. Yeah, that's let's say it's that. It's the Cod Wars. It's definitely the Cod Wars. Supremacy. I think having your own things Iceland's big fishing industry and also their relationship with the US, I think this is true of all of the countries involved. So things like Norway's public would be protective over things that wouldn't necessarily involve the EU or wouldn't involve the EU anymore in any way and affect it. Things for instance, Iceland's relationship with the US wouldn't necessarily change, but the fear that it might. Or Norway, for instance, you could imagine their sovereign wealth fund. People would, scare tactic that would be affected in some way, and people would be like, "Oh, I don't want that." Or the big thing in Switzerland used to be, their like secretive banking arrangements, where effectively you could bank in complete secret in Switzerland, which is no longer the case, and they like are now signed up to a bunch of international like finance transparency things. So like those kind of things wouldn't necessarily be affected anymore and wouldn't actually be barriers to becoming membership, but like public sentiment means that there's a sense that it wouldn't be advantageous to join, and therefore in all those cases you're like, well, why would we want to do that? What if it negatively affects this thing? I'm not on board. Seems like a waste of my time.
Yeah. So last thing I'll talk about is like kind of the parties and public polling and opinion.
Oh, in Iceland.
An opinion. In Iceland, yes. So let's go to public opinion, because it has shifted quite drastically, all basically thanks to 2008. Mm. At points, polling was showing like almost 66% in favor. Mm. And like was that number was holding. Polling gets a little confused because a lot of questions around the EU are asked to the Icelandic public that aren't asked to other people. For example, resume negotiations is a question often asked rather than just, you know, joining. Mm. Are you in favor of joining is asked. And then, of course, because of the financial crisis in Iceland, the question of should we just use the euro is often floated by itself.
Mm-hmm.
After 2008, it becomes more kind of towards the side of saying no to all of these. The most recent polling averages kind of shows that there is basically a pretty hard against like majority for most of these questions. The joining the euro question has kind of like been dropped away in terms of polling nowadays. But like, do you want to join? If a referendum was held today, how would you vote? Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of goes to like 58-65% against.
Mm.
What's ever interesting is there is roughly between 10-15% undecided still. So chances are like half of that would go to being against if you actually ask them to vote.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah. So it's probably looking at like a 70-30 split.
Mm.
Then the only kind of thing that looks a little bit like it might is when you have the odd person, the odd polling company that asks the two questions, do you want to join, and separately, do you want to resume negotiations?
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting that you have both questions on there.
Yeah.
But the reason it's interesting is because they actually get two different results. Joining pretty much comes back always as like against,
yeah.
With like at the very minimum a 10% lead over being for. However, resume negotiations can win a plurality of support because the undecided gets a little bit larger in that. Mm. So like, for example, the most recent one was like 45% in favor of resuming negotiations. Mm. And that was above... and that was the highest of any like answer given.
Mm.
So that's weird that that distinction exists. Political party support, though, is nowhere near as good as Norway, mm-hmm. for example. Mainly because the traditional center-right party of Iceland is against joining.
Yeah, right.
The Independence Party, noted for... Monsac Francesco, constant scandals and looks the Panama Papers and all that. A fun party, but still like important in Icelandic politics, are against it. And then pretty much most any other party that gets seats currently in Iceland is also against it. Mm-hmm. The Left Green Movement, the Progressive Party, the Centre Party are all emphatically against it, mm-hmm. with like the Pirate Party and the People's Party basically either being viewing it as a non-issue or just not having a statement on it. The only two parties that are in favor of joining are the Reform Party, which are quite small. Mm. They're kind of like a ALDE liberal political party in the center, and the Social Democratic Alliance, which is your traditional center-left party of Iceland. Both of those parties, though, are currently in opposition.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, that's... Yeah, I think considering it like an... To a certain extent, considering it like a non-issue in both Iceland and Norway, because they are part of a EA. Like the EA framework that kind of governs most of the things that would be, you know, problematic. And realistically, they've carved out specific reasons why, mostly fishing related, it seems, legitimate reasons why they might be kind of like, well, actually, we, you know, we're kind of going to be protectionist in this one thing for now. And Switzerland is just complicated.
It's interesting. I think what's noticeably frozen about the situation in both Norway and Iceland, though, is, while you're right, the EEA kind of offers this halfway house that makes it a non-issue. But then at the same time, even if you were to follow the like stated opinions of parties, there's basically no way, based on how like current voting patterns are, there's like no way to have like a pro-EU or pro-joining majority in either of these countries.
Yeah. Which is,
because
I think
there's always going to be coalitions.
I take the Icelandic Pirate Party's line on this as just like, I have no statement on the matter. It's just like, well, I mean, it's unlikely to change. The benefits would be marginal. Like, the representation is always good, which the EU would offer them, but it's not, you know. Neither of them are very big countries in terms of population. It's not like a big impact, and seemingly the populations don't care either, which is, you know, interesting, to say the least.
Well, Norway would be like, by the standard, like by European standards, would be like a lower to mid-sized country. It's comparable with like Ireland and Denmark, I guess. Certainly smaller countries.
Yeah, that's true. No, it's not like it wouldn't be insignificant. It's just, you know, it's reasonable for the population to just be like, yeah, we don't really care. It doesn't, like, it's not like we're enormously disenfranchised in a way that you know, massively affects the state today. It's not like they're like, they'd be otherwise one of the like the big players. Oddly, I think even though the Swiss population is probably like, the Swiss are the furthest away from the EU in terms of alignment on things, that's probably the relationship that's more likely to change in some way, because they keep, because of their complicated arrangement that isn't set up in like a fixed framework, they do like every few years run into a problem where the Swiss want to do this thing, it would break this bilateral agreement of the EU, or the EU are bringing in this new clause of the Schengen agreement, which causes problems in Switzerland, or the Swiss want to change how they deal with refugees, that causes problems. Like, because it's more complicated as a special case, and there's a lot of like political will in the EU to like, you know, plaster over it in some way and kind of come up with some new arrangement, I think that's the most likely country to change in some way in relation to this. Possibly with, you know, probably on the least likely end, like EEA membership, but some form of stupid agreement that, you know, no one will understand all the particulars of is probably the most likely.
Yeah. Well, that's the current situation with these three, and it's interesting. It is interesting. I do like it. I basically don't see a way forward unless, like, to be honest, my takeaway from this is that the onus to change is probably now on the EU.
Yeah, right. Yeah. In terms of Iceland and Norway, probably.
Yeah. I have heard people joking about Switzerland, like, basically the only way this would ever work is Switzerland annexes the rest of the EU and we all just become cantons in the Swiss system.
No one wants that. That would be that would be awful.
I don't know. I want to have a bunch of sexist referendums.
No, I'm okay. Thanks for the offer.
Look, we're the only country promising you sexist and Islamophobic referendums. All right, we're a unique partner on the table.
I mean, I'm not taking it off the table. I'm just saying, like, not right now. Thanks for the offer. Goodbye.
And on that note, that has been another bonus episode of Previously in Europe. Thank you so much for everyone listening right now for helping us make these episodes and supporting the Patreon. Keep doing that, because we need it. Mm. We need it. We're all starving. That's my starvation cough. you cough when you're starving. I don't know. Anyway, myself and Hugh greatly appreciate all the support you've given us. And if you're listening on the regular feed a month later, well, just know it's a month later. That thing I said earlier about the Irish elections, that's outdated now. Mm. And whose fault is that?
Yeah.
Probably mine. But either way, thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.